The dream is energy independence. The reality is an economy dependent on hydrocarbons. And so we ask, can local gas turn energy dependence into energy independence?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1211th edition of the Food Chain, or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in St. Petersport who are tuned in as the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, the United States has become energy independent by fracking oil loose from the earth that has held it captive for millenniums. This fracking has given us the ability to thumb our noses at those who have an abundance of petroleum still in the ground and continue living on daily bread trucked in from thousands of miles away. But there is a certain amount of whistling past the grave to this newly found ability to frack our way to energy independence. We all know that sooner or later, we're going to frack our way right back into energy dependence. And we will do so with an economy that has become even more dependent on petroleum. It would seem that the real smart thing for we the people to do would be to figure out now how to become independent of the need for petroleum. Obviously, there are those who do not want us to become independent. They prefer we remain dependent on them. And given how much money they make on our dependence on them, they will likely go to great lengths to hold us captive. So, how do we become energy independent when they will do everything they can to keep us energy dependent? To find an answer, we head to Freedom, California, for a conversation about local gas with David Bloom, who is the owner of Bloom Distillation, farmer at Whiskey Hill Farm, and author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Dave, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Well, good morning, Michael.
Great to have you aboard. Let's see. Bloom Distillation, you distill, you farm, and you write. And we've been talking together for a long, long time about this whole notion of ethanol and this whole notion about growing our energy. And it started way back in Food Chain Radio show number 496.
Wow.
Yeah. And we're at 1211. And the subject at the time was cellulosic ethanol. And the this was back in 2006. And the whole notion was that somehow we would be able to spin grass into gas, kind of like Rumpelstiltskin did. But the times were very interesting then, way back in 2006, because oil was, what, $100+ a barrel?
$140
a barrel. And we were trying to figure out how we were going to survive. And I remember David Woolsey held up this whole notion of cellulosic ethanol. And we did a program on that, you and I. But what happened to cellulosic ethanol?
Well, of course, ethanol is also called moonshine in the common parlance, and well, we've been making that a long time. But we've been making it from things like starch and sugar. Mm-hmm. You know, whiskey is made from corn, and brandy's made from peaches or fruit or whatever. But the alcohol is the same. And you know, no matter what you start with, whether it's starch or sugar, or technically even cellulose, which is plant fiber, it's all made of sugar. You know, and what does a plant do? Well, it breathes in CO2 and drinks water. And, well, that's a carbohydrate. In other words, carbo is carbon dioxide, hydrate is water. And what glues it all together is sunlight. Plants do this without even thinking about it, even though it's somewhat of a miracle.
Kind of God's gift to the world, don't you think?
Well, alcohol or sugar, I'm not sure which it was.
Well, you know? and photosynthesis.
Well, photosynthesis is certainly a gift. And yeah. And when we see photosynthesis in action, I'm looking here in our radio studio, and I'm noticing that this beautiful, you know, polished cement table we have here has 2 2x4s holding up the panel. And the 2x4s, of course, are made out of cellulose. So anyway, when it gets down to how we make alcohol, we don't really do very much. It's really nature that does almost all the work. So plants make the starches and sugars. And if it's a starch, well, heck, there's 35 sugar molecules all linked together. And that's what makes it different than just a simple sugar like the table sugar on, you know, when we put in our coffee. But if we go ahead and take those long chains of sugars, really long, like 10,000 sugars long, and put them next to each other like two threads, and then have them linked to each other, well, that's cellulose. And that's why wood is so strong. It has all these, you know, interlocking parts. Well, to break wood apart into individual sugars is quite a challenge. It's technically possible, but will it ever be economically feasible to make alcohol out of those sugars than it would be out of sugar beets or peaches or apples or corn or any other number of things that we're able to grow very easily? And so the answer is no. And the pursuit, as we talked about at that time, of cellulosic ethanol was a distraction the oil companies threw up in front of us to see if we'd go after the hardest thing possible and ignore all the things that actually worked. And it was successful. All the grant money in the universe went to figuring out how to turn your kitchen table into fuel.
So, looking for that magic enzyme, right?
Or fancy process, or patented this or that. Because remember, if the only thing getting benefits and subsidies would have been cellulosic ethanol, then only those who could afford the patents would be able to do it. But making moonshine, that's mankind's second oldest profession. You can't patent that.
And a sin, for sure.
Well, because, yes.
Yeah, means you're taking care of yourself. So, and after that, you know, 100 shows later or something like that, we started talking about the food or fuel notion. The federal government was, you know, really getting into the ethanol business in a very big way. So we were looking at a situation where we might be growing fuel instead of food. And there was a conflict in that.
Well, you know, that's what everyone said, that there was a conflict there. But what you and I discussed is what Perry Mason used to tell us. There's, y'all remember Perry Mason, you know, he's at the start of the trial, and they have you put your hand on the Bible, and it's, you're going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So it's true. 40% of our corn goes into alcohol plants, and out comes alcohol. Well, that's true. But the whole truth is the corn goes into the alcohol plant, and out comes alcohol. But also what comes out of alcohol is de-starched corn. We call that distiller's grains.
Yum.
Well, it is kind of yummy, actually, but mostly, of course, our corn goes to feed cows, which they really think it's yummy. But if they eat straight corn, well, they have a really bad case of gas, because basically cattle can't digest starch. See, they're different than
right,
us.
They're grass eaters.
Correct, Michael. They love to eat cellulose. Remember that really long chain that yeah. we can't economically break apart? Well, cows can.
They have the stomach for it.
And they have all the little critters, all the little bacteria living in there that do the job. So, but when you feed them starch, they can't handle it. Yeah, they don't have enzymes. They don't have acid stomachs like we do. And so, if we feed them distiller's grains, which is de-starched corn, instead of the original corn, they gain more weight than they would if they ate the whole corn. So that's nothing but the truth. The reality is that if you don't ferment the corn to make alcohol, you have less food.
So in a sense, by turning corn into ethanol, we're getting a twofer instead of a onefer.
Well, it's a threefer, because not only is it you're getting animal feed and therefore more meat, you're also getting your alcohol, but you're getting healthier animals because all that starch causes tremendous digestive problems and, you know,
bad gas.
Yeah, you know, and in some cases you have to stick a tube down the cow's throat to relieve the gas so it doesn't explode. I mean, corn is not the way cows were designed to digest. So we get happier animals, we get less manure, we get less methane. You know, it gets to be more than a threefer. But the whole point was what we get out of this is a farm economy where farmers actually make some money. And most of the alcohol plants in the United States are owned collectively by farmers. And they get a share of the revenue for all the alcohol fuel they produce.
So good deal all the way around.
Well, except for the oil companies.
Yes. Now, which leads us to food chain number 692, we ran into cheap oil. And now we have a situation where we're, where the price of oil is way back down, $50 a barrel or something like that, or maybe 60 or something these days. But all of a sudden, what was really economically feasible, maybe not so much anymore. What do we do now?
Oh, you mean making alcohol because oil was expensive and now it's cheaper.
Now it's cheap.
Well, you know, the nice thing about us humans is we learn and we get better at things. And so over time, since the first alcohol renaissance in modern times, which was late 70s, we've brought the cost of production of alcohol down from $2.50 a gallon to down well below $1.50. You know, in fact, right now, alcohol sells wholesale to the oil companies at about $1.50 a gallon. So,
and of course, they pass those savings on to us, right?
Oh, I've noticed that. I get that rebate check from, you know, Mega Oil Run every month in the mail. So, so basically, alcohol has been a good deal for the oil companies because alcohol is 106 octane. Now, you know, it takes a lot of chemistry to make the chemicals that bring gasoline up to a higher octane. Gasoline comes out of the refinery at about 60 octane or so.
Wow.
So you got to add stuff to it. And alcohol turns out to be one of the cheapest things you can add to get the octane up to where we want it to be, which is, of course, way below where it was back in the 60s, which when we had, 104 octane was not a problem. And regular was 96, and it was, you know, really all good quality gas then. Well, now, if you want to have really good high-octane gas, you want to go ahead and buy what's called E85, which is sold at the pump, and it's 85% alcohol and only 15% of that oil company stuff. So it's well over 100 octane, even with the oil stuff in it. And all the guys with little street racers and everything, you always see them lining up at the alcohol pump because you get so much more horsepower from alcohol.
Zoom. So moving right along to food chain number 1165, we started talking with David Bloom about local gas and how you have been working to bring all this home to your farm and your community.
Well, that's always been my goal, because in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, I talk about the effects of what happens when you import your energy. So when you import energy, you have to pay for it.
Or food or anything else?
Well, already everything that's not local. But in the case of oil, the money leaves for transnational corporations and sits in Swiss bank accounts, and that money is not circulating in our economy. Now, you look at the Midwest, where they have alcohol plants.
We're going to have to pick that up. Hold on. We're going to take quick break. Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson with David Bloom, and you do stay tuned right back. Okay, we're getting to my favorite part here, which is bringing all of this home local. We're talking about ethanol, turning local waste into something that's really usable and beneficial to our farms and our communities. And it's possible. And we're doing it right here in Freedom, California at Whiskey Hill Farm, David Bloom. So we're talking about bringing this technology home to the farm and to the community. Where do we start?
Well, you know, let's look where it's already done in modern times, and then we could look a little further back. In modern times, we have a couple of hundred large alcohol plants in the Midwest. And by large, I mean like 50 to 100 million gallons per year. These are pretty big outfits. And half of them are farmer-owned, you know, so that's a really good thing. But what happens in those communities is really different than the rest of the Midwest. There might only be, in the alcohol plant itself, 50 employees, but they're really well-paid. And in the community, they're the people with the disposable income. So the hairdressers are constantly busy. The bars are bustling, you know. And because everybody is spending money, the money they make from alcohol, instead of money leaving the community to pay some oil company retirement fund, these guys are generating taxes. And so, wow, the pools are open. The libraries are open every day of the week. All these subtle things that happen when money stays local and circulates and creates more transactions and more local taxes.
Some years ago, I did a radio show from the Phil and Barbara Hamburger farm in South Dakota. I think they had 10,000 acres or something like that.
Wow.
Corn and soybeans. And their ranch house reminded me of being on the bridge of an aircraft carrier. You're way up there. You have all of these instruments, and you're looking out over an ocean of corn and soybeans. But after the show, I was heading back to wherever I was going, and I went through to the little town that they lived in. And the Boy Scouts, it was a crazy day's celebration. So all the merchants put their stuff on the sidewalk, and the Boy Scouts were out there selling hot dogs. And so I thought I'd stop and get a hot dog and say hi, and I did. And it was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I said, "How's business?" And they said, "Well, you're the first person that's come by."
Oh, my.
So, and there it is. You know, the technology of that industrial agriculture has really depopulated the countryside. And what you're saying is that this is the way to bring it back, bring life back to the rural communities then.
What do we make alcohol from in the United States? And if you're looking at the big plants, it's corn.
And
there's
corn.
A side of corn. But basically, when it comes to alcohol production, what if you're looking at a different kind of farming landscape? What if this year you're growing sugar beets, which have 1,000 gallon per acre yield? Well, that beats corn at only 300. But what if you're also growing Jerusalem artichokes that have 1,100 gallon per acre yield this second year? And you can have a rotation, who knows, of maybe 6 or 7 crops in a community, where your soil is never being depleted of the same nutrients time after time. And so as those crop rotations move through many different farms, you end up having less and less and less pest problems, because it isn't a corn banquet every day. It's, well, you know, a corn borer comes up in a field of beets and goes, "Well, I have nothing to eat here," you know. So you're talking about, by going into crop rotation with animal feed and energy, the same things we do now with corn, but with multiple different crops, now you're talking about being 80% on the way to that O word, the organic style of agriculture. Mm-hmm. And it's effortless and it's profitable.
And it's what we've been doing forever.
Well, it's so true. And that equipment in the community rotates around from farm to farm depending on what crop you're growing that year. So it's not everybody growing corn and everyone needing all the same equipment all at the same time.
So let's go to local gas. And it's my notion that in essence what we're trying to do is replace hydrocarbon energy with carbohydrate energy.
Well put. Well, carbohydrates are different than hydrocarbons in that there's oxygen as well as carbon and hydrogen. That's what makes it a carbohydrate. So alcohol, which is a distilled carbohydrate, is about 29% oxygen. So this makes big differences locally when it comes to the air. You know, So, for instance, working with Michelle Rodriguez and Karen Osmondson over in Watsonville, we did a trial with some of the buses from the Pajaro Valley School District with a blend of renewable chemicals, alcohol being the main one, that we made in our plant.
And we all know what buses emit.
Well, you know, a lot of smoke and hydrocarbons, but what you don't know about what they emit, because of the way a diesel engine works, is all kind of other unburned or partially burned very bad chemicals, like benzene, toluene, and then many other very long words that have to do with things that are carcinogenic, mutagenic, tetragenic, meaning it harms fetuses, and just plain bad stuff. So here we have our kids sitting in a school bus, and school buses start and stop, and we all know what that black cloud looks like coming out of the back when they start. But while the kids are sitting there, they're in a cloud of diesel smoke, and they're breathing it. And the UN studied this and said, oh, my God, this is the worst thing we could do with kids, is have them sit in diesel smoke all day. So what if you had a fuel that was clean? Because busing is important. Well, I worked on a project in New Zealand with Mercedes, and we had two buses there that for the World Alcohol Conference in that year, 1980, that ran on pure alcohol. They were modified diesel engines and had almost no measurable emissions.
Now, at your distillery and Whiskey Hill Farm, I've seen you put on a demonstration. I think your assistant Tom did. And he had two glass saucers, and he put gasoline in one and alcohol in the other.
That's right.
And lit them afire.
Oh, yeah, you'll see that and at the tour on the 14th, too.
So the really interesting thing was the gasoline burning. A big, huge, angry orange flame with black smoke. Just huge amounts of black smoke. And this is gasoline. This wasn't diesel. But the glass saucer with the alcohol had a beautiful blue flame with no emissions that you could see at any rate. So what were we seeing there?
Well, you know, that's the thing about gasoline. What is, you got to give Rockefeller some real credit. He had a business providing lighting and heating fuel back in the early 1800s, you know, the kerosene lanterns right. were the light of the day. And of course, there were oil heaters. But all the volatile stuff, you know, the stuff that boils at a low temperature and all that, like benzene, well, if you put that in a glass, you know, lantern with a wick and lit it, well, that's called a Molotov cocktail, ooh, right? That's yeah. a bad idea. So all that volatile stuff he used to flush into rivers at night to get rid of it. And the rivers would catch on fire because oil floats on water. Well, so what has happened since is they now have cars. And what they can do is take all the waste products from all the things they make from oil. Let's say today they're making linoleum or pesticides or plastic wrap or bags. And whatever's left over, they throw together and they call that gasoline. And it's never the same 1 hour to the next in a refinery because it's all the waste products. Some of that stuff will boil at room temperature. Some of that stuff won't boil until it's 500 degrees. It's like tar and varnish, but it all melts together in the gasoline. When you burn that, well, some of it burns pretty well, and other parts of it don't burn well at all. So that's where all the black soot
that was the black soot that I saw coming off the fire.
Absolutely. And so...
And the flame itself was orange.
Yes, it's full of all kind of things that are partially burned, and that's what gives off that yellow mm-hmm. and orange flame. So here we are taking the garbage left over from the oil industry, and then we burn it, and it's no surprise that it produces a lot of kinds of pollution. Hydrocarbons, that's the soot. Carbon monoxide, which is not very well combusted carbons, because it's only one oxygen, carbon monoxide. You and I breathe out nice, stable carbon dioxide, or two oxygens. So that
we at least emit them.
Well, we emit them, yes. Yeah. But the monoxide is actually very poisonous. And it's one of the things we regulate about fuels because it is so poisonous. And you know how we found out it was poisonous from fuel?
Somebody fell over dead.
In the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
Well, the guys were out there in their boats with their little motorboats, right? And out there fishing, and all of a sudden they fall out of their boat dead. Well, think about where the lake is. It's at the low point, right? I mean, by the very nature that it's the water, it's inside a canyon, and the carbon monoxide would start rising up as it, you know, was being produced, and then the guys would start breathing it. It grabs onto all your blood cells and doesn't let oxygen grab onto them, and then whoosh, you fall out of your boat. So that's how it started being regulated, because people figured out there are other kind of canyons that you could be at the bottom of,
like Manhattan, Fifth Avenue.
City streets. And it was damaging kids' ability to learn because it would mean they didn't get enough oxygen because of the carbon monoxide. And then the nitrous oxides, well, that's the brown stuff in smog. So those are the three big measures. Now, right here in town is Holiday Smog. And they're actually not very far from the station.
Right.
And I went in to get smogged on my alcohol, my truck, which I had alcohol in, but I didn't tell them. And so they put in the probe in the back, and they're looking at their, you know, their gauges, and they get a quizzical look on their face. And whenever something doesn't appear to be working that's electronic, how do we diagnose it?
Yeah.
We bang it, right? We see if something's
like the refrigerator or something.
Yeah. So anyway, he does that, and then the second thing you check when something electronic isn't working is you go to see if it's plugged in. Mm-hmm. You know, well, it was plugged in.
Check the connections.
So anyway, then I told him, don't take apart your machine. It's, you know, it's actually expected because this alcohol has essentially no emissions. And so when he realized...
Which is what I saw in the burning saucer. I saw this beautiful blue flame that had almost no orange it at all. It's just a beautiful blue flame.
Yeah. And so when we have alcohol in my pickup truck, my little Ford Ranger, I have zero carbon monoxide. I have zero hydrocarbons. So that's infinitely cleaner, right? When you have zero.
Zero is clean.
And then carbon or nitrous oxides, they only had 4 parts per million, but I was allowed by the test to have 400 and still pass. So that's 99% cleaner.
What did you do to your 2000 model Ford Ranger to be able to burn alcohol in it?
In my case, I did nothing whatsoever. It came from the factory as what's called flex fuel. And what it means is the software is a little bit more sophisticated so that it can adjust for a wider range of air fuel mixtures and take advantage of alcohol's high octane. And because the computer has just got a little more brains in it, it takes care of it without my even thinking about it. I can put whatever I want in the tank, gasoline, alcohol, and it all runs just fine.
Now, you say alcohol has a much higher octane rating, and yet when I saw the fires, I saw this great big huge angry flame, but this delicate little blue flame from the ethanol.
Well, you see, octane is a measure of will the fuel explode before it's supposed to. In other words, is it kind of unstable? So in the old days, those of us with gray hair remember pinging in our cars. We'd go up a hill and we'd go tap, 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 tap. That was the fuel exploding before the spark plug fired.
I think they called it pre-ignition or something like that.
That's the technical term. The rest of us called it pinging. But at any rate, alcohol doesn't do that because the high octane means it's very resistant to pre-ignition. And so that makes it a very helps your car last a lot longer. But it also means you can squeeze the fuel tighter before you set off the spark plug and you get more power. And that's what high octane means.
The other thing I noticed was that when the flames had burned out, when the fuel had been consumed, the dish that held the gasoline was pure black.
Yes, it was.
And the dish that held the alcohol was clean as a whistle.
Yeah, it was, you know, just a little Pyrex dish. You can see right through it still. Well, you know, that's what's going on in your engine. The reason why your oil turns black is all that carbon is coating the inside of your cylinder walls, just like you saw on the inside of the dish. So then you got to change your oil when it's too full of carbon, because carbon is microscopic sandpaper wearing down the inside of your engine. But with alcohol, I've been at Archer Daniels Midland out in the Midwest on their million-mile alcohol test with a over-the-road tractor trailer. And we tore the engine down after a million miles, and you could still see the original machining marks on the inside of the cylinders that had been so little wear.
Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Then Food Chain number 1211. And way back when, gosh, I think it was Food Chain number, let's see, here it is. It was 496, so that long ago. We picked up the story of ethanol with David Bloom, who is the owner of Bloom Distillation. He's a farmer at Whiskey Hill Farm, and he's the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And we picked up this incredible story of bringing energy home to our farms and our communities. Oh, my God. What are they going to do to stop us? Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, Dave Bloom, what are they going to do to stop us?
Well, I can tell you what they have done in the past and how we're trying to outwit them this time.
Okay, so here's what we're doing. We're looking at the opportunity to grow and process our own fuel, a fuel that is much more efficient, much cleaner, much more beneficial in all respects than the hydrocarbons that we rob from the earth.
Well, yes, and it's not the first time that a country's tried to run on alcohol. Germany used to do it. At one point, before the end of World War II, Germany had 77,000 community alcohol plants all over Germany processing potatoes. Potatoes, they grew like gangbusters in Germany, really good at it. But they didn't have any oil in Germany. They had coal, but no oil. So, you know, here we are up to World War II. Everybody else is running on fossil fuels, and Germany is still running on alcohol. And it was a key factor in World War II, because World War II, we decided to take the Germans out of the equation, and we looked for their two or three oil refineries to bomb them, and there weren't any. There were 77,000 farm-scale stills all over the country. We had to bomb all of those to get rid of the fuel supply for the German war machine.
It's interesting because pretty much the same thing happened on the other side of the Pacific with respect to Japan. You know, we had to take their oil to shut them down. And that got me to thinking with respect to the kind of technology you're talking about. Wouldn't it be incredible for a country like Japan, that's you're essentially an island unto yourself and you have no petroleum?
Well, actually, next month, I'm going to another island. I'm going to New Zealand, which wants to bring together a whole lot of alcohol fuel production. Prior to World War II, tankers didn't deliver oil to New Zealand, and they remember that. Because, you know, after New Zealand, the next stop is Antarctica. There's really not much business out there.
It gets cold down there.
So what's happening is from a farming point of view in New Zealand, is they are gigantic milk producers, and they sell a lot of their milk to China. And unfortunately, for better or for worse, you can think of New Zealand as an entire northern country covered with pee and poo because of all the cattle grazing on every possible surface, and that runs off into rivers and into the ocean. So this has been an issue because one of the biggest industries is a farming industry, you know, is the big National Farmers Co-op. But they run the dairies on coal. Again, they don't have oil either in New Zealand. So the new government has said, you've had enough time. You've had 100 years to fix this. You got to do it now. And so they're calling me and a couple of my tech partners down, and we're going to fix this. And so what we're going to do, and you'll see that at the farm tour that when you come out on the 14th, is that we can purify water using cattail marshes, just like outside the window here of the studio. So when you have a marsh, all that highly enriched, nutrient-rich water running off the cow fields would go into the marsh, but then the cattails absorb all that nitrate and phosphorus and and grows like crazy. And we get 7,500 gallons of alcohol per acre from cattails compared to corn at only 300 gallons per acre. So we're talking about an enormous amount of energy recycling all that cow exhaust.
So how are we going to get around them? Because they're not going to want you to do this, David.
Well, I'll tell you, Michael, the whole thing was I tried to have the revolution on television back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And as we all know, who are those of us who are older, remember Andy Warhol said, the revolution will not be televised. And he was right. So I got crushed in that one. I had a PBS TV series that was crushed off the air by the oil companies. Well, maybe I was a little young and optimistic, but now I have a different strategy, which is the attack of the mosquitoes. Small plants, local plants, run by farmers and waste from food processing, etc.
Running school buses,
and none of the plants are mega plants. They're like little plants, 5 million gallons per year. And so an oil company would look at that and go, that's not even a rounding error. Mm-hmm. So let's not pay any attention to that. We have other things to do. So over time, though, that little mosquito taking that little drop of blood from the economic system of oil, well, if there's enough mosquitoes, someday the oil companies will say, what happened to all my blood? Because we'll all be taking little drips.
So now we're working in the little town of Watsonville, California, and showing them how we can take a lot of the farm waste products. And Watsonville is in the heart of the Pajaro Valley.
Correct.
Salinas Valley. Tremendous ag production per acre. But it's not corn.
No, it's not. But it's all kinds of things. And we can make alcohol out of all kinds of things from, you know, various fruit pulps. We can be using, let's see, I think they grow just a couple strawberries in Watsonville. In fact, half a billion pounds of strawberries are grown in California, north and south, during the year. And 25 to 30% don't make it into the basket because they're not pretty enough. That's a lot of sugar. And we actually harvest, when we make our alcohol from strawberries, we also get strawberry furanone, which is very popular scent and flavor of strawberries, which we can also distill aside, and we collect the seeds. And you go, well, what are you going to use the seeds for after you cook the strawberries? Well, you know, you can't put those little balls of microplastics anymore in soap to, you know, scrub your skin, but you can put in strawberry seeds as an exfoliant.
Wow.
We get $16 a pound for those. So we're not just an alcohol plant. We're a biorefinery. And like I said, there's no waste at Whiskey Hill Farms. Everything goes to use in some way. We make our own massive compost. We make our own liquor. Oh, no. Was I going to say liquor? No, I didn't say that. No, we also, of course, return all the nutrients left after making alcohol and methane from those nutrients. We put all those essential nutrients that crops need back on the land. So, you know, there's just...
Nothing gets wasted. Everything gets used many different ways. How does a community get started? Where do we start?
Well, you know, it's really simple. Santa Cruz County Bank...
this is the local bank.
Our local bank here came to us after we addressed an industry meeting over in Salinas. And they came to us and said, what you guys are doing are great. We want to lend you money. Now, I don't know about you, but banks don't usually go around asking people to if they can lend them money. But they thought what we were doing was really important. So Santa Cruz County Bank will put up 70% of the cost of our putting a plant up wherever we want to do it in California. And
so we're talking about the place to start then is with a community distillery.
That's right. And the community, in one way or another, can come up with the 30% of the money that is needed to put a plant up, and then we will bring the bank and they'll put up the rest and we can put a plant up. So for instance, in Florida, Tropicana has all this orange pulp they're trying to get rid of, and price of corn is low, so they can't sell it to the farmers in animal feed anymore. And so we're going to do something in their county where locally.
So the place to start is to look for a problem. Look for waste.
And the problem is the solution. And there are 20,000 food processing plants in the United States that are big enough to support a bloom distillation alcohol plant in a community. So we can do this all over the United States and all over the
and
world.
And kind of be like Germany in World War II.
Except better.
Mm-hmm. Now, has the technology improved over the years? I mean, are we better at making alcohol than we were before?
Well, you know, making alcohol is kind of mankind's second oldest profession, right?
That's what I meant, yeah.
So it's kind of old. It's pretty well understood, and we don't do it. The yeast do it. But we have gotten good with things like computers and electric valves. And so, yes, we can do things maybe more efficiently now. And we've all learned how to breed things better. Even without genetic modifications, we've been able to get yeast to do a better job. And so, yes, we can make alcohol better than they did back in Germany. And it can be a vibrant part of the economy. And it would provide 26, let's have the drum roll here, billion new jobs in the United States. That's billion.
Making booze.
And fuel, mm-hmm. and pharmaceutical alcohol for making drugs, and beverage alcohol is for booze, and fuel. We make all those with our plants, but 26 billion jobs would reverse all the Reagan-Bush slashes and job numbers that we had, and then the current, and since then the various little depressions we've had, we'd have full employment again, and no one would have to worry about whether or not that Mexican fellow over there has taken my job or not, because everyone will need to be working because we will have that many jobs, because we are making our own energy, and it's saving the country a fortune.
Which is the essence of local economy and local independence, which is what the goal is. The dream is that energy independence that will allow us to fuel our own communities.
And just think of when you go to fill up your tank with fuel for your vehicle, you don't have to really just feel sick to your stomach. There's only one thing to put in the tank. You'll have a choice.
So you're working with the community of Watsonville, California's school buses. And you went to them and said, hey, there's a different way we can do this. And what was their initial reaction?
Well, they're very progressive at Watsonville in the mm-hmm. Pajaro Valley. And they said, wow, this would be better for the kids. And this is largely due to a school board member, Karen Osmondson, who championed for us to come in and do this trial. And so, you know, that's what brought it to the attention
of the superintendent. So did you have to change the school bus engines in any way? What did you do?
Well, in this case, we were told not to change a thing. They said they didn't want to get into any alterations. We had to come up with a blend of things that would work in the diesel engine as it is. Hmm. And, you know, in my book, Alcohol can be a gas. Yeah, that's very good. You remembered that. There are six different ways to work on diesel engines to make them run on alcohol. One of them is to add stuff in to the alcohol, like a little biodiesel for lubricating the pump and the injectors and a little other stuff to get it to ignite at the right time. And all that stuff's renewable. So we did a blend and we ran it, and it was relatively successful, but you know, if we could just change a few little adjustments on the engine, it would have been a lot better. Well, now the law in California is diesel is being made illegal. Within a few years, no diesel will be sold in California.
Wow.
And
how will we get our food?
Well, because alcohol can run diesels just fine, and we're working with the California Energy Commission and the governor's office to show them that we can provide a good methodology for being able to run any diesel engine, diesel generator, maritime ship, fishing boat, all the stuff we run with diesel engines,
airplanes.
Locomotives. Diesels don't usually run airplanes. Well, they run kerosene and jet engines, and absolutely they already can run on alcohol, and the Air Force does it.
Wow.
Yeah, and what's nice about it when the Air Force does it is it leaves no hydrocarbon trail.
No contrails in the sky.
Ah, but see, the hydrocarbons are what modern missiles look for when they try to find a jet to blow it up. It's not a heat-seeking missile anymore. It's a smog-seeking missile.
Wow.
And so if they slam over to alcohol, the emission trail disappears and the plane can veer away. And the Air Force has been doing this for about 12 years now.
David Blum, it all seems to be too good to be true.
It does, only because we've been told this: there is no alternative. There is no alternative. It has to be oil. But then there's Brazil. It's a country as big as the United States, pretty much. It doesn't import any oil. None. It runs the whole country on alcohol. So have you heard of that? Most people in a crowd that I ask, have you heard that there's a country that doesn't import oil and doesn't need it for running their vehicles? No hands go up. It's like, how is that happening in a freedom of information economy or a country like ours? I got to say, it takes a lot of effort to keep that news away from Americans.
Well, there's a lot of money in the hydrocarbons.
Well,
and essentially, they have us. We are dependent on hydrocarbons.
And they spend $3 billion a year denigrating alcohol in the press to make sure that we are a little bit afraid of it so we won't try it in our cars. But, you know, we are Americans. We are the inventive tool makers of the world. And
we hate being dependent.
And we hate being lied to.
Above all. Do you think it's possible that we can become energy independent? Do you think that so many of our small towns can make their own carbohydrate plant? Yeah.
We're an agricultural country. We have an immense amount of land we're not even cultivating because we don't have a market to sell the stuff to. This creates a new market. Energy is a new market for farming, and the byproducts could feed the world. You know, the dried distiller's grains we talked about earlier in the show.
So you think we can actually grow our own fuel?
We only use 90 million acres of corn right now, and it replaces 40% of our gasoline. Now, you think that's a lot of acres, 90 million? The United States has 5.4 billion acres. We have tons of room to do this.
Okay, folks, his name is David Blum. He is the owner of Blum Distillation, the farmer at Whiskey Hill Farm, and the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And it's always a gas when I have you on the air. David, thanks for joining me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.